My sister sent me a photo of like Selena Gomez in the bathroom of her wedding with Taylor Swift and Miley Cyrus and Ariana Grande. And I dead ass was like, that's AI. Like, I just didn't. It just looked so... No, like, I think it was real.
I've not seen it. Like, I haven't... I didn't even really realize she got married until I went to a pub quiz. And that was one of the questions.
Well, let me send you the photo so you can see.
Because that does sound like an AI committee. Like, I can't imagine...
It fully looks like AI. So my sister sends it. She goes, teen girl squad. My mom goes, nice to see they're still a squad, heart. They don't hang like they used to.
That
like,
is
what are you talking
so
about?
So funny.
Yeah, I mean, my parents are like way more tapped in on celebrity culture than I am.
Wait,
they're
but
just
I also like love your
news.
Mom's investment in this like non-existent friend
group.
She's
not. Like, I was like, you're capping. She doesn't care about this at all. I was like, what are you talking about?
You're capping. This is like not a group of people who historically have like been known to hang out with each other also, which is really funny.
Doesn't it look AI?
That's fake.
It's definitely fake because Ariana Grande is like half the height of these women. And like Miley Cyrus is taller than, I'm pretty sure she's, and like Taylor Swift would be towering over them.
That's also Ariana Grande's hair from like 2017.
Yeah, I think this is AI.
That's not Miley Cyrus's face. Like that looks so weird. They wouldn't all be bridesmaids.
No,
like
they're
all wearing
wouldn't.
The same color. Also, it's from Facebook and everything on Facebook is AI these days. Literally, Facebook doesn't let you scroll down very far anymore. It'll just be like, okay, that's enough for today. And so
you're scrolling on Facebook?
Yeah, because I was using Facebook Marketplace.
Ugh, love.
And then, you know, you'll open up Facebook and then you're like, oh, this random person is married. That's crazy. And then I'm like, I wonder who else is randomly married that like I don't have on Instagram. So you'll scroll down your feed. Half of it is like stuff like this, this AI ass photo of Taylor Swift and Ariana Grande at Selena Gomez's wedding.
It's hard to watch your parents get got by AI. You're like, damn.
Squad goals alert. Taylor Swift, Ariana Grande, and Miley Cyrus showing their love and support for our girl Selena Gomez on her special day. These queens are not only attending the wedding, but also standing by Selena's side as her bridesmaids. Women supporting women is ultimate goal.
Yeah, they definitely are not her bridesmaids. Like, Ariana Grande was never a part of this clique, and I don't think Miley Cyrus and Selena Gomez were like, friends. I love that I'm like fact checking. I'm like, I remember that.
This is just also a photo of Ariana Grande from literally 10 years ago.
Yeah. She don't look like that anymore.
Like, she's a different human being now. Like, that's not what she looks like.
AI is so frightening.
It's so weird. But also, speaking of vintage Ariana Grande, I have a story to tell you.
Oh my God, spill.
So in July 2015, a 22-year-old Ariana Grande walked into a Los Angeles donut shop with a group of friends. While the shop employee was out of view, Ariana and one of her friends approached an unattended tray of powdered donuts and began licking them one by one. Ariana then goes on to say, "I hate Americans. I hate America." This incident was captured on the shop's security cameras and leaked to TMZ, who posted the video online. The backlash was immediate. Not only was Ariana being openly unpatriotic, but the donuts she victimized that day were sold to unsuspecting customers, and the donut shop in question was subjected to a reevaluation by the health department, who downgraded them from an A to a B.
This was pre-Belle Delphine selling her bathwater. Like, Ariana Grande licking the donut, like, that could have been sold all over the web.
1000%. Unfortunately, they also didn't realize she'd licked the donuts until after they'd sold them.
Oh,
famously.
No.
So they couldn't even monetize on it.
I'm like, how can they monetize that?
She's a hustler. You got Kris Jenner brain.
Get me a dermaplane facelift while you're at it. I found wrinkles yesterday.
Ariana addressed the public outrage directly by tweeting, quote, "Need to clean up this mouth of mine and set a better example for my babes. I apologize and I love you. Always learning." Attached to the tweet was a screenshot of her iPhone Notes app, which contained the following statement. "I am, all caps, extremely proud to be an American, and I've always made it clear that I love my country. What I said in a private moment with my friend Ryan, with two N's at the end, who was buying the donuts, was taken out of context, and I am sorry for not using more discretion with my choice of words. As an advocate for healthy eating, Food is very important to me, and I sometimes get upset by how freely we as Americans eat and consume things without giving any thought to the consequences that it has on our health and society as a whole. The fact that the United States has one of the highest child obesity rates, just rate, in the world frustrates me. We need to do more to educate ourselves and our children about the dangers of overeating and the poison that we put into our bodies. We need to demand more from our food industry. However, I should have known better in how I expressed myself, and with my new responsibility to others as a public figure, I will strive to be better.
Wow, she wrapped it all into one.
She really did.
She really did. She did PSA. She was doing some Jamie Oliver. It's like the Dixie Chicks got, you know, persecuted for being unpatriotic, but we never talk about Ariana.
We never talk about Ariana. It's true. I guess she's like stole enough in people's boyfriends to kind of trump her tirades against America and their food industry. So this to me is a beautiful artifact of internet history because one, it's sort of deliciously ridiculous in a 30 Rock, like Jenna Maroney from 30 Rock kind of way that I don't think celebrities do enough anymore. It's so out of touch. It's kind of beautiful. But also the apology itself contains multiple grammatical errors as well as the sentence as an advocate for healthy eating. So though Ariana appears to have deleted this statement from her social media, and I think she did so pretty quickly, she made history that day because this is the first notable celebrity notes app apology.
Whoa.
In this week's episode, we're going to dive deeper into the notes app statement, its use as a PR tactic, and our skepticism towards the public apology. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Aya.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. If you like our show and you'd like to hear more from us, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast. If you don't want to join the Patreon, you can like and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts because that helps us out a lot. In the years to follow Ariana's anti-donut manifesto, the Notes app would come to replace the daytime talk show as the favored format for celebrities to directly address the public. By the next year, in 2016, New York Magazine was already calling them, quote, ubiquitous on celebrity social media. And some notable, pun intended, apologies from this time include when James Charles apologized for being ignorant about the country of Africa after tweeting about not wanting to get Ebola on a school trip.
It's crazy that he got canceled kind of in the exact same way that Justine Sacco got canceled, where they both tweeted something kind of like offensive about diseases that are prevalent in Africa, got on a flight, got off the flight, and they were full-blown canceled.
Yeah, it's like if I had a nickel for every time. And then James Charles's apology is pretty beautiful because he starts it off basically being like, all these people were trying to like construct like a PR statement, but I'm just going to apologize from the heart because I don't think that's like how you're supposed to do an apology. And then he went on to call Africa a country twice.
Oh, bless him. It's an American education system. Come on.
Yes, yes. Exactly. And that's what he should have done. He should have gone on a tirade against the American education system a la Ariana Grande.
Yes, yes. As an advocate for healthy learning.
So other instances of notes app apologies from those years, it was Kendall Jenner apologizing on behalf of her and Kylie's clothing brand for trying to sell shirts that superimposed photos of them over photos of Tupac and Biggie.
That's really funny.
YouTuber Logan Paul famously posted a notes app apology after he filmed his Suicide Forest video in Japan.
That one was not funny.
And then more recently, Justin Timberlake posted a No Top apology after he was caught holding hands with his co-star from like a movie, even though he's like very publicly married to Jessica Biel. He also then posted another series of No Top apologies apologizing to Britney Spears and Janet Jackson like 20 years late. Justin Bieber also like kind of posted a crazy No Top apology from around this time where he basically meditates on like his experience growing up in the limelight and like his experience as a child star, but then goes on to like vaguely apologize for just like random behavior of his and like his treatment of women. But it's kind of, I don't know, there was something almost like philosophical about it. That boy, I think, tends to really like big Instagram statements.
Or that time that he commented on Hailey Bieber's photo where he said, "Bae's boobs," and that he did like two eye emojis. And I clocked that and I said, that's so fucking funny. He's a wordsmith.
I'm always struck when it's very clear that a celebrity runs their own Instagram.
Bae's boobs. That doesn't... You know, they say, step aside Tupac. Let Justin Bieber cook.
Yeah, Bae's Kendall boobs. Jenner, why don't you superimpose a photo of Justin Bieber over your face?
Yeah.
So before we talk more about the Notes app apology, I want to talk more about the Notes app itself. What are your like Notes app habits? Like, what do you use it for typically?
Oh my God. So funny you should ask. All right. So let's go through it. I have a list of every single person I've ever slept with. I have a list of my friends in New York because I kind of forget who I know here because they're kind of disparate. They're disparate.
That's so funny and also like so devastating if that gets leaked and then someone isn't on there.
It's just they're all so kind of like spread apart. Yeah, they're ranked. No, I'm kidding. But they're like kind of spread. Like my friends are all spread apart and there's not like a cohesive friend group. So sometimes I'm like, I leave someone out of something or I forget like, oh, I should hit this person up.
Oh my God, you're such a Virgo. What the fuck?
I have a lot of work stuff, random notes here and there, like leftover stuff from different projects. I have like nutritional advice on here. I have a list of baby names. I have a list of like takes in case anyone were to ask me my take about something. I have one.
That's like the most Maia thing ever. I just have to like interject.
Yeah, mama. Say. I have a list of celebrity crushes. You know, we got Skeet Ulrich. We have like a...
Of course.
Gregory of Peck, course. Naturally.
The obvious.
Jeff Buckley's obviously the first one. I have a list of...
You have a list of words you like.
I have a list of strip songs, good songs to strip to. I have a list of songs to do karaoke to. I have obviously leftover like wall of text messages to various exes. I have essay ideas. I have, yeah, that's kind of it. That's like most of what I've got. I got a lot on there, but I use it for everything. And I'll do like a daily list. If I have like something to do in the afternoon today, I'll make a list of those things and then just delete it at the end of the day because I'm like, gotta.
Do you delete notes after?
I'm not trying to have that all stored in my iCloud, you know. Storage is limited.
That's a really good point. I just like have, I've just hoard notes. It's like random notes.
No, that's amazing.
All that space.
That's amazing.
No, yeah, I use mine kind of similarly. Like definitely have a karaoke song list, grocery list, to-do list, brainstorming, writing down something that like I will absolutely forget if I don't write it down immediately. When I go to like art galleries and I want to remember the names of artists, I write them down because I get embarrassed taking photos sometimes in art galleries because I'm really judgmental about other people's photo taking behaviors. Aww, in art galleries.
I've kind of owned it recently. Like I will, yeah, I'll take a photo of something that I like and I'll just be like, hey, whatever.
It depends on the gallery and how populated it is, but like, it's like, it's my new thing. I've become such like an old curmudgeon about.
No, I get it. I get it.
But yeah, like usually my notes app is like fairly practical for the most part, my use of it. But I don't know, I've been thinking about like the notes app and I feel like something I find very interesting about it is that in the grand scheme of our like digital lives, it's one of the few places where you're technically creating things, but like those things in question aren't really made for public consumption.
Mm.
So like, you know, when you take photos on your phone, like obviously not every photo is going to be shared, but there's sort of this expectation embedded within the app's function that those are photos that will probably be seen by someone else's eyes. And then, like, you know, you think about something like Strava and like music apps, all of these kind of elements of our life have social functions now, and like we just literally did an episode about stalking and like
stalking someone's Spotify playlist.
Yeah, like the weird little ways that we're like stalking each other and our behaviors, and that can be monitored. And so those behaviors are then kind of being shaped because they become almost content. And, you know, the Notes app obviously has like a group notes function. We use them sometimes when we're like joint brainstorming something. But generally speaking, like the app has stayed kind of the same over the years.
And may it never change. May it never change.
May it never change. I think I really appreciate how little innovation has been done for the Notes app, because ultimately, and it took me a really embarrassingly long time into working on this episode to kind of reach this like epiphany, but the Notes app at the end of the day is just a digital notebook. And it feels really dumb to call something analog that's on your phone, but it's one of the most analog aspects of the smartphone life, I suppose.
Yeah.
And so in thinking about it as a notebook, it did make me think of Joan Didion's essay on keeping a notebook, which is the first essay or like piece of her writing I'd ever read. And I don't know, I was just like obsessed with it when I was younger. But in the piece, Didion talks about the notebook as the place where we write for like an audience of one in these abstract and like fragmented and, you know, sometimes inaccurate terms, that even when we're kind of going back over them as our future selves, we can't always decipher what we're talking about. And, you know, going through my Notes app with that in mind, like I was coming across these like strange things that I couldn't fully remember the context of. But then when I was trying to remember and I was looking at the date and I was trying to place what was going on in my life, it kind of forced me to think about like and reflect on those periods in time and reflect why I'd be writing them or like why certain things stuck out to me. And this, like Joan Didion argues, is the real purpose of the notebook. So she writes, "I think we are all well advised to keep on nodding terms with the people we used to be, whether we find them attractive company or not. Otherwise, they turn up unannounced and surprise us, come hammering on the mind store at 4 a.m. of a bad night and demand to know who deserted them, who betrayed them, who is going to make amends. We forget all too soon the things we thought we could never forget. We forget the loves and the betrayals alike, and forget what we whispered and what we screamed, forgot who we were." And I don't know, I think there's something really true about that, and something that does, I don't know, like Didion kind of writes about the notebook and people who keep notebooks in her piece as a specific breed of person, the people who have to compulsively write things down. And I think that maybe before we had, you know, the smartphone at our disposal, that was a person who was making a conscious choice to carry around a notebook and a pen and write things down. But now that is something that I think more people have incorporated into their lives. And I think it's kind of a nice practice, even if we're not consciously doing it, because it's not like a diary. It's a keeping of records that are almost not important enough to keep elsewhere.
Yeah, yeah, it's very, there's something extremely mundane about it in a way that I find enjoyable. I find it so enjoyable. I love the archival aspect of it because I don't really keep a diary or journal. I wish I did. I have one, but I just don't use it. I never remember to. I think like since I got out of school, like the act of writing, I find kind of physically difficult. I don't know if it's, I mean, I'm convinced I have pre-arthritis, but maybe it's like my little pre-arthritic hands or something. But I find it kind of difficult to write these days with a pen. And so I find the Notes app, I know that's horrible chimp brain of me, but the Notes app, yeah, there's something so comforting and delightful about it. And like, I was just at an event where we had to print off our Notes apps, like different notes from the Notes app, and then kind of scrapbook them and like annotate them. And I was like, yay, finally someone gets to see my Notes app.
Well, yeah, there's something really interesting because sometimes you'll write stuff in there and you're like, this is brilliant. This is so interesting. No one is ever going to see what you wrote. it feels important enough to write down, but not important enough to actually escape the walls of the notes app.
Yeah.
Except when you go through it and you're like, wait, why did I need to write this? Like, I was going through and I found a note that was like, watching Finding Nemo making me emotional. And I was like, why did I write this in my notes app? I also don't remember watching Finding Nemo in the past 5 years, but I did.
No, you did. I actually remember this, I feel like.
You remember that. Okay, yeah, so somebody did see it.
In our shared home, but in our shared home on the premises. But no, it's nice. It's like a fleeting thought that I think is beautiful. And like, yeah, maybe you wanted to revisit it later, or maybe you were pushing me to make a video about it or something. Sometimes Hannah will get really interested in something and be like, you need to make a video about this.
Yeah, I really want her to make a video on Frank Capra for Christmas, and she won't.
I'm just skipping December this year, but I would love to. I know this year sucks because I'm skipping October and December, which are the 2 months that you could do like a themed video. It's a bummer. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to talk about Frank Capra. I fucking love It's a Wonderful Life. Next year.
So when we think about the Notes app in this regard, then, like, as this rare place on our phones for, you know, introspection, why do we think it's been the choice format for the celebrity apologizer?
Well, I think going back to that concept of intimacy, like, I think that it kind of belies a sort of like personal touch. Like, it's almost like someone wrote it again in a scrapbook and took a photo of it to show the work that went into it. Like, I think with a PR statement, it's hard to kind of authenticate the person's personal hand in the writing of that statement. Like, you know that someone else did it for them, so it kind of shows that they don't care. Whereas with a notes app, it's supposed to kind of reveal that personal element and the labor that goes into writing the note. And I think like the typos also kind of suggest that as well. Like, oh, I wrote this myself, you know? I'm a human just like you, you know? You're knocking yourself down a peg when you apologize, so.
Yeah, like Brian Feldman at New York Magazine called them one of the true joys of the post-tabloid age, a perfect example of the democratization of social media in which even the rich and glamorous are forced to use the same cobbled-together kludges as the rest of us when they need to publish a lot of texts on a site like Instagram.
Well, it's like funny even thinking of a celebrity, you know, looking at stories. Like, you're like, oh, they use this app too?
Well, no, exactly. And then it's like, like we were saying, like, there is a real simplicity to the Notes app. It almost feels dated just because it feels like the least optimized aspect of, like, the iOS lifestyle. So,
ew, the iOS lifestyle. Kill myself.
But I agree. And then also, an article in Vanity Fair also pointed out how the Notes app apology disrupts the feed of, like, an otherwise curated celebrity Instagram page. So there's something about it that's almost like humbling, because they're like, you know, when a celebrity's trying to seem very sincere about something and they post a video and they don't wear makeup, it kind of feels like the equivalent of that. It's really,
well, they're like defacing the feed. Yeah, it's ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I would say, like, there is also a spectrum of authenticity when it comes to the Notes app statement or apology, because, you know, James Charles and Ariana Grande, I think both of those statements felt pretty clearly penned by the people posting them. Ariana's was so unhinged. It had typos. She did delete it afterwards. James Charles's, I mean, what publicist would let you apologize about an Ebola tweet and call Africa a country? Like, presumably none, unless they were really going for authenticity. But both of those incidents were pretty early in the lifespan of the Notes app apology. So I think they were genuinely just, like, utilizing this tool because not everyone was on Canva yet. And they're like, how do I type something out and post it? But I think in the cases of both the Kendall Jenner apology and Logan Paul's apology, if you were to read them, they have these very clinical styles to them. Like, they're so obviously written by somebody that isn't them. Like, there's no way that it was Kendall Jenner's writing style. It's very formal. I don't even know if Logan Paul can write. So it just feels like pretty haha. But within a few years, like, people started adopting the format to get messages across that were phrased and created in a way that was very similar to the traditional PR apology or statement.
Yeah.
And one of the first kind of clear examples of this where we knew that that was taking place came in 2017 when Taylor Swift posted a Notes app statement to her Instagram addressing her feud with Kim Kardashian and Kanye West. Basically, Kanye West put out the song Famous. He said he wanted to sleep with Taylor and because he made that bitch famous. And then she had I think it was a Grammy speech where she was like, don't let anyone take credit for your fame. And then Kim and Kanye were like, you approved of the lyric. And then they posted a video where she's like, is shown like approving of the lyric. It was doctored. But at the time, it really looked like she had been like lying to everybody.
Oh, so they were in the wrong. Because like, who was in the wrong there?
In the grand scheme of things, she had said that she took issue with being called that bitch. And in the video that they posted, they didn't include that, but someone later posted the full unedited version of it where she is addressing the things that she said she took issue with.
Mm.
So I think that she was being made to look more deceptive, but
it's like she, I think everyone's annoying in that context. Yeah.
Yes. But in 2017, we didn't have that unedited version. So what we have is someone who seems like they're taking this to like fuel this narrative of like, I'm standing up to this guy, but technically she was okay with it.
Mm.
And so she posts this Notes app statement and basically like everyone was already questioning her credibility because the video had leaked. But then in the Notes app statement where she famously said she'd like to be excluded from this narrative, it's clear if you look at the top that she'd found it using the search bar. And people online sort of deduced that that meant that she'd written this statement far back enough that she had to use the search bar to find it.
Yeah.
Even though it was posted pretty quickly after the video. So it felt like it was this organic, like, oh shit, all this is going down. I'm going to like quickly respond to this.
It was manufactured.
It seemed like this was something that she knew maybe was going to come out. So she'd had this on hand. And then also on the image, it like if you write on Notes app and then you like scroll down and write more, if you scroll down, you can still kind of see the faint remnants of the words that were typed above. So people zoomed in and noticed that more had been written. So it seemed like she'd been working through drafts or she'd cut something out that no longer seemed relevant, but it just sort of fed into this narrative that she was lying about, you know, her complicity in the whole feud, I suppose. And it just sort of also confirmed to people now who were catching on and memifying really the Notes app that this is being used in this really disingenuous way to try and make celebrities seem more relatable.
Authentic.
Or like, yeah, exactly. Or like they writing their own apologies.
To give her like benefit of the doubt, like maybe she also had the conversation with him, kind of didn't feel great about it, and then immediately was like, oh fuck, like I'm gonna have to say something. You know what I mean? Like maybe started constructing, but maybe not in such a malicious way as people would assume. Also, the drafts also show that maybe that does humanize her a bit to me too, where she's like, ah, no, this doesn't work. Like, let's try this. But like, I don't know. I give her a little bit of the benefit of the doubt there.
You're such a Taylor Swift apologist now. It's so funny.
I don't know what's happened to me, but I think that, I don't know, like, I feel like I'm someone who anticipates things a lot and like kind of gets paranoid about things or kind of like stressed about things, and I'll write stuff in my Notes app to just like have the thing there in case in a more emotional moment I don't fuck up something else. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to explain it, but I understand maybe why she did that.
I also think these are like the communications between some of the biggest celebrities in the world. Like, obviously there are publicists and teams mediating in this and their correspondences, like, obviously.
Yeah, she was definitely like crisis managing or like talking to people through this in a way that's like, I almost preferred that to her just brazenly posting something with a bunch of typos that maybe like would, I mean, I guess this all made her look bad anyways, but like, you know, I don't know.
In this moment, people were already mistrusting of her, and like there was this sort of preconceived narrative that she was this very calculating person and sort of like he's fake and all
that. Well, that
these
she was
things.
Like trying to end all these men's careers by writing songs about how they suck. Yeah.
And then I think because she's using this format that people are kind of dubious of, or that feels like if you are misusing it, feels really manipulative. It didn't really help her or the Notes app apology.
No, it definitely doesn't look great, for sure.
Yeah. And people are definitely right to be suspicious of the Notes app apology. I found this interview for Vice that the writer Hunter Harris did where she spoke to an anonymous celebrity publicist, and they broke down like the public apology crafting process, basically. Mm. So the publicist told Harris that timing is very crucial. So enough time should pass, basically, that the apologies don't seem reactionary, but they should be quick enough that they don't feel like they've been forced out or like encourage a domino effect where people are, you know, mad at you and then they start unearthing like past behavior or like more indiscretions that you've done on social media.
Well, so many times it's been a double take where like Logan Paul, for example, from what I remember, like posted an immediate apology that was not really an apology. It was like horrible. Deleted that, then posted another Notes app apology from what I can remember about that incident. Like, it was two apologies. And a lot of people have done that where they'll post the first apology, that's not good enough. Then they'll post another apology where they're like, I've actually thought this through even more. And here's what I have to say now. And like, I wrote that in a rush. So I think, I don't know, it's interesting. And it's in both cases, often the Notes app is used to do so.
Yeah. Well, it's just like really interesting to think about like the kind of performance of it, I suppose. They also said that, you know, they might have a client write a first draft from the heart, but that obviously then they will exchange many drafts back and forth with them until it's become, you know, the right apology and they have like checked all the boxes. And so they're like, oh, if, you know, their first draft isn't like compassionate enough or like doesn't take enough responsibility, then we'll be like, okay, it's good. Your feelings are here, but now we're going to make people actually like accept this apology.
Well, I think a huge element of friend bonding has been to like draft up some wall of text to someone who's like you feel has wronged you and then crowdsource it to your friends and have your friends edit it for you. The amount of sat with a friend and have them be like, oh no, not that, like say this instead, you know. It is kind of human, like I don't know, it's funny.
Actually, the amount of like drafts in my Notes app that are just things that I've sent to boys that I had Maya help me construct.
You and I have done this so many times together.
She's my PR team.
As are you. Usually you're like, just don't send that.
Yeah, usually I'm just like, refrain, let it pass over, let the scandal move on, the news cycle will continue. And so then they'll also like, interestingly, like arrange a statement so that if it's being posted on Instagram, say, and they have to use multiple slides to kind of get the message across, they'll put all the important parts at the beginning. Like they'll address everything on the first page so that if people keep scrolling, they'll at least like see the important bits or like the main points, which is also interesting to me.
Yeah, they always get kind of general and vague by the end where they're like, I've worked for this and like I love you, you know.
Yeah, but it's like you gotta like hit all the main beats, which immediately makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
being moody doesn't have to be a bad thing. Sometimes it can be fun to lean into how we're feeling by surrounding ourselves with things that match that feeling. Our moods play a big role in our choice of music, food, even lighting. So why not extend that logic to cannabis products? This is possible thanks to our sponsor, Mood, an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC products right to your door. Gummies that only get you high? That's so passé. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. And with our promo code Rehash, you can get 20% off your first order at mood.com. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, sleepy time to get you settled for a restful night, or chill out for some needed relaxation. THC gummies are everywhere these days, so why not go with a brand that lets you customize your experience? Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. The best part is, Mood ships directly and discreetly to your door. That means no more waiting in dispensary lines, and no risk of an awkward run-in with your mom's friend Mary. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code REHASH. So head to mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code REHASH when you check out to save 20% off your first order. Guys, the holidays are just around the corner. Personally, I like to get my shopping done early. The only problem is I'm always holding out for the perfect gift, which isn't always easy to find. Luckily for me and my loved ones, Quince has me covered. With Quince, you can find luxurious gifts like cashmere sweaters or Italian wool jackets for super reasonable prices. Hannah told me she's never felt fancier than when she puts on her new Mongolian cashmere sweater from Quince, and she loves to see the shock on people's faces when she tells them it was only $50. Plus, her fingers are going to stay nice and toasty all winter long thanks to her beautiful shearling gloves. And if you thought Quince was only looking out for the fashion girlies, you thought wrong. Quince has gifting options for everyone in your life, from the home cooks to the world travelers. I, for one, have been cooking up a storm in my stainless steel sauté pan, which I bought after having a freak out about nonstick, but that's a story for another time. Find gifts so good you'll want to keep them with Quince. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
I thought it was fascinating to have someone like come out and admit to this process, even if, you know, as the public, we're already assuming that it's taking place in some capacity. And so now I want to talk a bit more about public apologies in a broader sense, and also what we want from them. So I'm curious, like, what makes a good apology for you? And do you think that those same standards would be applied to a public apology versus like a private apology, or are the expectations different?
Ooh, I feel like I'm in a pretty unique position where, like, when it comes to public apology, in the position I am, I staunchly believe not to. And I'll say why in a bit. But in terms of just like a general apology, I think recognition of what you have done, here are the things that I think I maybe like misstepped on, here's what I think I can do better, look me dead in the eyes and be like, I'm sorry. You know, I think there's a lot of talk around people who are like, I'm sorry you felt that way, and the way that that kind of like evades accountability, like self-accountability. So I think like just being like, I'm sorry is important. I feel like I apologize all the time. I mean, I'm Canadian, but like, I feel like interpersonally, I feel like pretty comfortable with apologizing for things or like admitting what I did wrong. I feel like if I'm in a conflict with someone, I like the conflict to end as soon as I can. Or like, I think that, you know, you'll have like a conflict and then a moment of catharsis of like, oh no, this is bad. And then kind of like, okay, here's what happened. So yeah, I think a recounting of where you misstepped, recognition of how you maybe think that can change, and then I'm sorry is good to me.
Yeah. I think that that's sort of become like the golden standard for apologies, for sure. I think especially if we're talking about like an interpersonal situation, I think that's probably always the best way to handle it. One of the things about being an adult is learning how to apologize, I think.
You'd be amazed at how many adults don't know how to. What was the second part of your question also?
So do you think that those standards, like for you, would they apply to a public apology? Like, is that what you want out of a public apology?
No, I don't want anything out of a public apology. Like, I don't know. I just have really turned around on them over the years. I think historically I was like, you know, I was really into accountability and like, I was like, you know, take account for yourself. But I've become extremely cynical towards like parasociality and this expectation that like every celebrity needs to be as pure as possible. I think if a celebrity has done something so terrible as to like, you know, inside the criminal justice system, like, I don't even want an apology. I want to see, you know, some form of justice happen. I don't know about prison, but like, you know, like some form of justice. With like celebrity misdemeanors, I can't bring myself to care because it would reveal that I have some sort of parasocial relationship where I feel like I'm going to feel better if they apologize for their actions, when ultimately it's like, who are you apologizing to? What do you owe the public? And I think what I learned from Lindsay, I know it's a case by case basis, but what I really learned from Lindsay Ellis, who, what I believe happened, and we have an episode about it, was that she like defended herself, immediately got taken down even more because she like responded to the backlash with what was happening to her, the really stupid backlash that was happening with her. And then I don't think she's ever actually apologized. And I actually really appreciated that, because for her, apologizing would then be recognizing some sort of truth or validity in the criticism of her. and it was invalid. Like, I think a lot of people were like, listen to the valid criticism, listen to the valid criticism. And it's like, no, none of this fucking criticism is valid. It's all coming out of bad faith. It's all bad. And all of you are bad faith actors, like, across the board. And so I think that's made me really reticent to apologizing in general. I think every time I've apologized, it's just opened up more room. And I've done it a lot. It's just opened up more room for people to then be like, it makes you fallible. And it makes it so that you're not like this distant public figure. It like puts you in close contact with your audience, who then feel like they can do it again or like throw tomatoes at you. Like you basically make yourself closer to the tomatoes. I feel very strongly about putting out a perception of myself to the public that I'm like a do-gooder, because I find people who do that end up getting taken down the hardest. Like they put themselves up so high that the further they can fall. And I feel like that was revealed to us, like, in the first season. I think that's most evident, you know, with like the Try Guys episode with Ned Fulmer being this kind of like beacon of like good guy sentiment getting just like completely taken down in this like cheating scandal. And like other people, like someone who has not positioned themselves as good of a person would not be able to fall so far. Like Trisha Paytas, for example.
No, for sure.
She's not as fallible. And so I think, I've learned a lot from that. In my general life, I try to be as good a person as I can. But I don't need the public to know that. Like, I don't owe them that. Like, I don't owe them any sense of my own morality, because I just don't feel beholden to them. And so, yes, I've just stopped caring about apologies. Because what do I want from this person? Like, I don't feel owed anything by them. I don't know them. So yes, that's my very long-winded answer.
I think, and I agree with you about public apologies. I think from what I've seen, that's like definitely not the wider public's probably approach to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people would argue that those standards of like taking accountability and just saying sorry should be present in a public apology, or at least like those are the standards that we've like raised for celebrities. So I found this study, and admittedly, it's like from pre-social media, pre-notes app, but it's like from 2000 to 2012, the study published in Social Psychology Quarterly, where the authors examined 183 celebrity apologies from those years, and they categorized the apologies first based on like their angle, like their style. So the categories are, first, people who choose to deny their like wrongdoing, that it happened at all, or like that they were the one who did it. Then there's people who evade responsibility for it. They try and pin it on someone else. Then there are people who reduce their role or the impact of their actions. Then there's people who take corrective action and promise to do better. And the last one is taking a stance of mortification, which is like asking for forgiveness and admitting guilt like wholeheartedly. Based off of what we know about how the public has typically responded to apologies, what angle do we think was most associated with the highest apology rate?
Mortification seems to be the one that everyone goes towards.
Yes. Ding, 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 ding. Yeah. They also categorized them based on how they were like sequentially structured. So you have victim-driven apologies, which are ones that lead with a reference to the victim. Then you have offender-driven ones, which focus on the offender and like what's going on with them. Then action ownership, which begin with the offender linking themselves to their actions. Then you have context-driven, which are ones which begin with like trying to give context for the event. And then you have double casting, where the offender depicts themselves as both guilty and a victim. Which do you think would be the most effective? And like, which one do you think had the highest
guilty
forgiveness
rate? Victim?
The victim-driven one, yeah.
Oh, victim-driven in general. Like, this is how you guys have been affected by this. I would assume guilty and a victim, but no, yeah, it's a completely
no,
like arms up.
No, people don't like that.
The ones that people like the most. Yeah, I'm assuming guilty, arms up.
You're like, I'm so sorry, this is horrible, I'm admitting guilt, and it's all about the victim, and
the public is like the SWAT team outside the house, and the celebrity is like the hands up murderer walking out of the house.
Yes. This makes sense to you, right? These two being the most effective.
No, it makes sense. Yeah. Well, like Lindsay Ellison, I just reference her for everything because I do think what happened with her was just completely paradigm shifting for me and like how I approach everything in my career completely. Maybe so deeply cynical. But she kind of described it as like people want you to slit your wrists and want to watch you bleed. Like that is kind of like metaphorically, like in an in-person apology, you want to feel like you've healed your relationship with someone. You want to feel like you can move past it. But with audiences asking celebrities to apologize, there's more of an element of like schadenfreude. Like you just want to see someone stripped naked, basically. You know what I mean? Like stripped of all artifice. You want to knock them down below you as an audience. And so I think the complete vulnerability of I'm completely in the wrong and I'm sorry. And like there's no defense. You're not allowed to defend yourself is what people want out of that. Like there's an insidious subtext to asking for that admission of guilt and asking for the victim driven apology, I think. But yeah, so yeah. I can see why it would be so popular because I do think audiences are acting from that instinct.
1,000%. Mostly. And like, I think we just like, we do live in like a very punitive society where if we think someone's guilty of something, we have a very easy time completely stripping them of their humanity in a way where it's like someone you don't see as a human being. You don't really want to like know why they did the thing. You don't want to like hear their defense. And I think we have this weird kind of instinct to assume that someone trying to mitigate something, like their role in something, or just like provide context, like we always take that as like amoral. But yeah. I think it's like very natural to want to do that and sometimes called for. Like sometimes actually knowing the context for something helps us understand it and maybe reduces its harm at times, or like reduces like,
totally.
I don't know. I think it's like a much less cynical take on the world to assume that people aren't just like acting from a place of malice all the time and to
context
understand.
Context and nuance are important. Yeah.
Yes.
And obviously I feel differently versus, you know, about like Logan Paul in the Suicide Forest to me revealed that he has mildly like, I thought it was more revealing of something systemic of like, oh, people who are engaged in influencer culture have completely lost their humanity and like their ability to see human beings. They see everything through a screen as a form of content, as something to capitalize on. It reveals something about Logan Paul's character that's like very insidious versus like Ariana Grande licking some donuts is a little bit bad behavior, but I do not fucking care. I don't care. Like, but we treat it like some mortal offense to us. And it's like, because she's not, like, I think women, and we've talked about this forever on this podcast, but are just held to this ridiculous standard that they need to uphold. But yeah, so generally, I think that context is important and interesting. Like, I'm nosy. I want to know what was actually happening. Yeah. But most people don't want that, again, because these people aren't human. We don't want them to be human.
Also, it just falls back into this thing where, like, we love to be retrospective about things and realize that we should have maybe, like, taken an easier stance or been more understanding. But we love to do it in retrospect and we never just want to hear it at the beginning when someone's like, hey, maybe we could like make less of a deal of this if we actually understood what was going on.
Dude, the people probing up Monica Lewinsky, for example, I'm like, every single last one of your chimp brains would have been absolutely tearing this woman to shreds in the 90s. Like, don't even pretend. You yeah. do similar things with other people just under different contexts, thematically different. But like, you do that exact same behavior with other people. You know,
of course.
So we like the CEO cheating scandal, for example, like it's just like it we are not different.
We get kind of a like a weird thrill out of like chastising the people of the past. But it's like we're constantly kind of teeing things up to like be material for that in the future. We're like, OK, one day when we have our heads screwed on, right, we will see this situation differently. But in the meantime, like, shame on this person, then the people ahead of us in the future or our future selves will shame us for doing such a thing. It's like,
well,
we just like
this cycle.
Well,
the worst part
about
this current day, like, iteration of the cycle is that, like, back then, at least there was a bit more honesty about, like, the ghoulishness of the behavior of the public versus, you know, like, the glee, like, the Perez Hilton-type glee in, like, tearing down celebrities. Whereas now there's, like, there's an element of moral righteousness that, to me, just makes it a trillion times, like, I hate it. Because you're saying you're doing good, but when you're kind of just picking up a tomato.
For sure. I read this really interesting essay about public apologies from the rhetoric perspective, from a rhetoric perspective by Adam Elwanger. He wrote it for the Rhetoric Society Quarterly. The essay was published in 2012, so this is, like, pre-notes apps. But I think his observations are, like, even more relevant now. So Elwanger argues that the public apology is a performance of something called metanoia. It's a rhetorical concept for, quote, a profound conversion of the heart. So he writes,
Public apologists are encouraged to perform a complete change in their public persona or ethos, a change that closely parallels the transformation that animates the Christian conversion experience. In other words, this turning away from sin is rarely an act of will, but rather a happening. In a moment of inexplicable clarity, one sees oneself for who one is, and in doing so becomes someone completely different. Metanoia is nothing short of a wholesale reconstitution of identity. So basically, he's arguing that like when a public figure apologizes, we're basically accepting nothing less of like a full-blown come to Jesus moment where they're like, I've had a change of heart. I'm a new person. I've been reborn. Something's taken over me.
And they fit the mold of what we want them to be. Yeah. The type of person we imagine them to be.
It's almost like we've like exercised this like malice from them and like they've become this new person because the old person we could never like accept.
Yeah.
We could never like reaccept this tainted person who'd done this thing. And I think, you know, going back to the earlier question of like why celebrities go for the Notes app apology, I think the Notes app apology also like really helps tell this narrative because it basically suggests that this celebrity has maybe been sitting there and just like had something come over them. They've like realized their wrongdoings, they're being reborn and they need to share it immediately. Like the kind of like, yeah, the immediacy of it, the sort of pressing nature of like, I'm going to forego all of these other avenues of communication and just speak directly to the people, type it out from my phone, whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think what the Notes app does is it like reinforces this idea that we need an apology to feel as organic, as authentic as possible, when even though deep down we sort of understand and suspect the fact that an apology is a performance. It's like a mediated process. And it's something where you are technically trying to talk your way into the best possible outcome for yourself a lot of the time. Like, especially if we're talking about a public apology.
Yes. I think there's a huge difference between public and interpersonal apologies because public apologies come from public pressure, like they're coerced, you know? And so a human being having some sort of Scrooge in the, you know, with the ghost of Christmas past, like come to Jesus type moment, like that is of your own will. That's of your own will and volition often. But like public apologies are inauthentic inherently because they're coming from public pressure and they're asked to do so quickly that the person doesn't actually have an opportunity to change. If we're actually asking them to change, they don't have an opportunity to change. They're just writing something out, like you're saying, to kind of change the situation for themselves. And ultimately, like, I don't think that it's rehabilitative in any way. Like, I don't think it's progressive. I don't think anything, because speaking from my own personal experience, the times that I've been like widely criticized about things, that thing becomes almost like, I hate the word trigger, but it comes a bit of a trigger in my brain. Like I start to have a negative association with the thing that I'm being criticized about, even if it's something that I love. Like if it's about a movie that like I love that I spoke about and people didn't like how I spoke about it, I start to dislike that movie. You know, I have causes that I care about so intensely that I like involuntarily start to have a negative response towards because people have been like, they don't like how I approached the cause, you know what I mean? And it's really disheartening. Yeah. But I think that goes for a lot of people who are being pressured by a public. I do think that it actually has like the complete opposite effect, and it's completely anti-rehabilitative, it's extremely retributive, and it's extremely anti-progressive.
No, but exactly. And I think it's just this thing where we're like, when we want people to apologize, like, we scrutinize the apology for its authenticity, for its sincerity. We scrutinize the person to see like signs if they've actually like taken to heart what they're saying. But then we've also, like you're saying, like we've pushed them to this place where they're giving the apology. So we can never be satisfied. So what this really ends up being, and this is what Elwinger kind of argues, is like, it's really just like a public humiliation ritual where no one's really getting, like nobody's satisfied here, but we can't punish someone for like, let's say saying something problematic, right? Or like that kind of an indiscretion. So it's like, rather than try and make out that we want to like make that possible, we've just like forced them to kind of be punished in a different way, like not legally, but like socially, right? And by forcing them to kind of
basically strip themselves down and like beg for our forgiveness.
Well, yeah, there's a due process in the court of public opinion, you know. No. It's kind of like a coerced confession. Like, you're like, see, what you did was wrong, say you're guilty, and it's an immediate admission of guilt. When, like, okay, Ariana Grande saying she's guilty for licking some fucking donuts in a moment that she was being surveilled without knowing is like, what is that, you know? What is that? What are we asking for? What do we want out of this? I guess to just restore, we're like forcibly restoring Ariana Grande's image for her, you know, and it's punitive.
Yeah. And then also, like, I think it keeps us in this state of paranoia. And like Elwanger kind of articulates this. He says, lurking within the public response to apologies and metanoia is this fear of what cannot be known. In both apology and metanoia, the only evidence of the inward movement is the testimony of the professed convert. So we're like taking them at their word, or like we're sort of forced to. But then I think that because, you know, we're skeptical about these apologies already and their authenticity, and yet people are trying to find these more creative ways to like obscure the elements of it that prove their like artificiality, like it's just making us more stressed and more distrusting. And I guess I'm curious, like, do you think our suspicions towards public apologies have forced them to become more manipulative, like using the Notes app, for example, or have they gotten so manipulative that they've forced us to become more suspicious? Like, are we suspicious because celebrities are always trying to like pull one over on us, or like do they feel kind of like they have no other choice because we're so skeptical of them?
I'm sure it's like a cyclical thing, but I, or like a chicken and egg thing, but I do think that I'm leaning towards our suspicion is driving the kind of more manipulative elements of it, because if celebrities didn't have to apologize, I wouldn't apologize, like, you know, it's and so I think they're forced into more and more sophisticated modes of apology masking as authenticity, you know, or like statement masking as authenticity. And then that causes us to be like, like trying to detect the inauthenticity there, which is funny. You know, like people zooming in on the remnants of word text from Taylor Swift's apology is like, okay, that's insane. we want celebrities to be bad. Ultimately, we actually want them to be bad because we enjoy it.
Of course.
And so it's what like Lindsay Ellis calls like mask off, you know. We're constantly trying to unmask people as like the Scooby-Doo villain, you know. Like Ariana Grande is not how she says she was. She's not a sweet little music theater girl. She's actually a donut licker, unpatriotic donut licker, you know. Logan Paul, I was like, okay, no one should be shocked here.
There's no mask on Logan Paul. Logan Paul's a dipshit.
He's there. That was obvious to everyone from the beginning, or should have been.
Yeah,
that felt like kind of the natural evolution of his behavior.
Yeah. But I think the funny thing there is trying to like somehow retroactively mask that by putting out a Notes app apology, which is supposed to seem very authentic, but then having someone write it in a tone of voice that is so clearly not Logan Paul's that it's like no person would read that and think he wrote it. I also think we're coming out of like this period where the goal of the celebrity in the 2010s was almost to be as quote unquote authentic as possible. Like that was a selling point. And so we were really obsessed with trying to obscure the hand of the publicist and of the team. We were trying to make things seem more genuine. You know, Ariana Grande also just like, for example, used to be on social media in this really messy capacity at the time of the donut licking thing.
Oh, was I following Oh Snap It's Ari back in like freshman year of high school, her YouTube channel where she posts covers and probably makes like somewhat offensive jokes? Yes, I loved it. I watched all of it.
She was tweeting about Pete Davidson's dick in like 2018, and like,
oh yeah,
it's literally been 7 years and that just wouldn't happen today.
Well, now we've just turned her into a fucking weirdo. She talks with an accent that she doesn't have because we've been like, she's like the masks, she's wearing like 5 masks.
For sure, she's definitely a masker, but I think even thinking about like Taylor Swift, like I don't think Taylor Swift would have posted that Notes app apology at all today. She's kind of like forgone any direct communication, or she's been very selective about how she communicates with
the public. She's wearing many masks, although maybe she kind of also went mask off because now she's a basic like anthropology girl, and that felt a little mask off actually, in the best way.
Perhaps. But I think like, do you agree with this? I think we've returned to like a more classic mode of celebrity after, you know, the 2010s felt like this period where celebrities were kind of toying with like how accessible to make themselves. Social media was new. we as a public wanted people to feel real. We wanted them to feel authentic. We didn't want them to feel like these like otherworldly beings that they felt like, especially in like the 20th century. Do you kind of think that maybe we're going back to that because people saw what could happen if you get a little too comfortable with the public, I suppose?
Of course. And I'm down for it. These people are not us. They are not attainable. They live completely, they live lives that are so completely different from our own. Are they human? Yes. But like, they're not attainable. I don't need these fucking people to be attainable. I don't need them to be one of me. I want them to do their work and I want to see it when it comes out. You know, I don't want to peek behind the curtain. I don't really care. I've stopped caring. I feel too old. Sometimes I like a bit of celebrity gossip, such as Jessica Chastain sits by the phone and has no friends. Like, that's funny. Have you heard that one?
Ridiculous.
She sits by the phone all day and waits for someone to call.
Honestly, so true, queen.
It's the funniest blind item. I need to know who submitted that. But anyways, otherwise, no, I don't care. Unless it's Jessica Chastain, I don't care. We're returning to the Bush era in almost every way, and it feels like culturally. And so that's just another iteration of that.
I feel like celebrities are not trying as hard to like pander to us. And I also think that the pandemic played a role in this when like it just became so clear the lines between the haves and the haves nots. But then having the celebrities be like, we're just like you, we're also locked down, but like in our mansions. But trying to be like,
Gal Gadot.
Wow. Yeah. Like just like they were like, look at this like democratizing thing that's happened where even we can't like go to a private island or whatever. But I think people have grown increasingly resentful towards that, and I think that the Notes App apology is sort of like a microcosm of that, because it like started off as this thing that felt like there was a lot of like understandable reasons why somebody would use it and like why it could be an interesting or like productive form of communication. But like it quickly became something that like one got abused, and also something that we all became incredibly cynical about, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And I think just like, I don't know, fed into this weird thing where like we were demanding people to feel like human beings, but we refused to treat them like human beings, I suppose.
It's also just like ultimately old news. Like it just, once something's been done too many times, the novelty of it wears off. Yeah.
Which leads me to like my final part of the discussion, which is I want to talk about the current state of the apology, because I feel like no one's really talking about this, but the Instagram story has sort of replaced the Notes app as people's way of like addressing the public head on. And it's interesting to me because I think if the public was dubious about the Notes app apology, then like Instagram stories to me are even worse, because one of the aspects of the Notes App apology that I thought worked really well in arguing on its behalf is the way that they kind of like aesthetically compromised the issuer's Instagram feed, like we were saying earlier. And like, especially if you're thinking about an apology as this like humbling moment or whatever, and we want people to perform it in such a way, then there's this suggestion, you know, when someone posts like an ugly Notes app screenshot, that someone has like sacrificed something in order to get their message across. Mm-hmm. But an Instagram story disappears after 24 hours. So I guess just thinking about like what we want out of an apology and like this whole discussion about like we want people to sort of kneel before us and beg for forgiveness, there is something so blasé about an Instagram story. Yet I feel like that's how people are communicating with the public these days.
It's
and
funny.
We're not talking about it.
I like when they post with their rainbow default background. So for the Instagram brand background, like give it to me. I want that. And I like that it's a piece of ephemera. Those people were deleting their apologies anyways, you know? Like,
but I think it's just, why is no one talking about it? When I thought about this, I was like, I feel like I have a tinfoil hat on my head because I'm like, no one's talking about it. No one's think pieced this to death. But it's weird that that's kind of become this, like, I don't know. I guess coming out of an era where apologies felt, one, like they were happening so frequently, and also they were being so heavily scrutinized that we started getting like really meta about like how to write a good apology. And when someone wrote a good one, we were like, now that's how you apologize, folks. Blah,
well,
blah,
I
blah.
Think it's playing into the fact that, like you're saying, the celebrities have turned, they've become more obscure to us, they've become a bit more opaque. So no one's really thinking about the Notes app as much. And I feel like also a story, yes, is ephemeral and it's like covert, like it doesn't exist on the grid forever, but it can also be screenshotted. And like often they are screenshotted and just posted to Twitter. So it doesn't feel like that far a leap from the Notes app in a way, especially if the Notes app's being posted to grid and being deleted 2 days later, you know. So I don't know. I see it as just like, it's probably, to me, it's just uninteresting, in my personal opinion. Like, I just, maybe because I'm fatigued by the apology culture, but like, I just don't care.
I felt like this was a really cool, interesting realization. You can't call it uninteresting and undermine my final thoughts.
I think that we can so agree to disagree, but I also have my pretty harsh stances about this in general that I'm sure many people wouldn't agree with.
I'm not against people making an apology on a story. I'm more baffled that the culture that has felt so kind of bloodthirsty about people's apologies and the art of apologizing has somehow been overlooking this. And
well,
I'm
because we're
just
seeing
a
major turn. I think it's like we're seeing a major turn in our culture. We don't celebrities are more opaque. Celebrities. Oh my god, I can't stop saying it. Celebrities are more opaque, and the public is fatigued. And I think that that's just ultimately what's going on. Like, I just don't think. I think we're just coming out of that era a bit. You know, post 2020, I think things have really taken a different turn. And honestly, like, I'm kind of glad to see it go, because I just like, I'll never stop talking about how, just stop caring about celebrities so much. God, it's just exhausting. Celebrity culture is exhausting.
That's true.
Hannah, I'd really like you to write me a Notes app apology for responding LOL to all my texts.
To my fellow Americans, first of all, I am deeply and extremely proud to be an American. And I need to learn to communicate better. As an advocate for abbreviations, I think that it's a shame that we as a country have gotten so far away from the message that we think that LOL is anything less than a genuine expression of laughing out loud at the joke of our friends. And as an advocate for healthy eating, I think that by typing fewer things in a day, what we're really doing is saving more time for chopping vegetables and eating salads. And so, to finish things off, I'd like to apologize to the country of Africa.
And me.
And Maya. And I promise I will not do it again.
That's amazing.
Thank you.